This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Congressman Rodney Davis is departing from the Trump administration position that includes the latest tariff threat over a non-economic problem.
I'm not in favor of them using tariffs against Mexico right now to address immigration issues.
Davis also says the president had the immigration solution before him last year. Plus, hear the voices of World War II veterans from Bloomington Normal as we observe the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings. Laura Kennedy delves into fan culture with the Psych Geeks, and John Norton introduces you to the GLT Summer Concert Act, the Rebirth Brass Band. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's nearly half of the Illinois corn crop will probably be a bust because it has been too wet to plant and is now almost too late to plant. Soybeans, too, are threatened because of the ever-present spring rain. Congressman Rodney Davis of Taylorville joins us to talk about that and other issues. Representatives of the Illinois Farm Bureau are suggesting a federal disaster declaration for the entire state because of the flooding and soggy fields. Is that merited?
Well, I'm certainly optimistic that we'll be able to get more crops in the ground over the next few weeks. And the farmers I talk to are actually seeing some progress right now. But I have concerns. I'm worried about them, too. If we continue to get some forecasted precipitation, which we've been lucky over the last few days that forecasts were not as accurate as they could have been if you look at last week's forecast. I'm optimistic that you're going to see a slower progression, but that's not going to take away the fears and the anxieties of our farmers who likely will have to take the preventive planning coverage that's part of the Farm Bill and the risk management tools that we allow at the federal government. This is a big concern for our farmers, but it should be a big concern for those in the industry, because if crops don't get planted, prices for the crops that do go up. And that means it goes up for everybody.
So I'm not hearing that you're quite there yet on a disaster declaration.
Oh, no, no. I if it gets to the point where a disaster declaration is going to be needed, we're going to help lead the charge. Look, I think we may have, if projections don't hold that the rivers in the Mississippi River Valley and Illinois River Valley are not going to be as bad as once anticipated, if that changes, which it could with a couple of bad storms, I said just yesterday we could be looking at asking Congress for another nationwide disaster supplemental bill. And that would be reminiscent of what was done in 1993 and 1995 in the Mississippi River areas. And this, Charlie, is one thing I thought about right when I got elected. I was a brand new member of Congress and debating on whether or not to vote for every version of Superstorm Sandy relief. I remember going to my New Jersey and New York colleagues and saying, I'm going to vote for every version of this bill because I believe that there's one thing the federal government should do right, and that's disaster relief. And one day, I'm going to be coming back to you because my district is going to experience a disaster along the Mississippi River, and I want you to remember me.
You're here in town today to highlight some opioid grants, one to Peoria-based OSF, Sisters of the Third Order of St. Francis in Litchfield, and the other one to Chestnut Health Systems for work in several southern Illinois counties, Clinton, Bond, and Montgomery. Tell us about that, would you?
Well, what these grants do is they take local organizations, and those local organizations have put plans together to really localize what they think is going to work best to reduce the opioid epidemic in our communities. These communities, Chestnut is going to be operating their procedures down in Bond and Montgomery County that I serve. Rural areas have much different needs when addressing drug addiction and opioid addiction than somewhat more urban areas like Bloomington Normal.
How do those needs differ?
Well, they differ, number one, transportation. Number two, location for beds that may be available for treatment and facilities that may be available for treatment. And then there sometimes may be a perception that you may not want to drive your car into the parking lot in a smaller community because somebody may see it there and know that you are there being treated. So it is a different type of scenario that these grants allow local professional organizations like Chestnut, for example, to go into that community, take the expertise they have in communities like Bloomington Normal, bring it down to rural Illinois and places like Bond, Clinton, and Montgomery counties, and address some of those institutional concerns that many of our rural residents have. And I used to kind of chuckle when people would tell me, well, people are afraid to get treatment because they don't want to see their car here. That's a real big deal. If you're dealing with an addiction, you don't want people to know it in many cases. And you're certainly not going to park your car in the front stall at the local opioid recovery center.
So is this going to be a template for a larger effort to tackle the opioid crisis? I mean, there are a couple hundred thousand bucks apiece in those two separate service areas, and they're going to handle 1 to 4 caseworkers and staffers to oversee it. Isn't the need bigger than that?
And the need's always bigger than that. But we've invested historic amounts of revenue and money into the opioid problems that we have in this country right now. Over the last Congress, we had hundreds of opioid addiction-related bills that we put together into one piece of legislation or another, multiple pieces of legislation that have provided hundreds of millions of dollars to our local communities. This is the result of the work that we've already done in Congress at the request of many who are fighting this fight on the front lines. These resources are what they asked for. This flexibility is what they asked for. And this is why we worked together in a very bipartisan way in the last Congress to allow these funds to be distributed to organizations that you mentioned and to serve our communities, both rural and urban.
Where do you think the nation is in addressing the opioid crisis? Are there new approaches that will tackle areas yet unserved, or have we got a handle on it and the rest is processing and catching up with the lag? Frame that for us, would you, in your view?
In my opinion, Charlie, I don't think we have our arms around the entire addiction process when it comes to opioids. I think we're doing a lot better when it comes to prescriptions being given out willy-nilly after minor procedures by our medical community. I think they're taking a second look before they write that opioid prescription. I can remember getting a minor procedure one time, 19, 20 years ago, and I was given a prescription for opioids. Took one and said, I'm never taking one of these again. I couldn't barely walk down my hallway in my house without trying to stabilize myself. I didn't use them, but I can't tell you when I threw them away either, because I'm sure they sat in my cabinet. So I don't think people will have that same problem nowadays, 20 years later, because doctors are more vigilant that you may want to try something a little less than an opioid to deal with any pain that may occur from the minor procedure like the one I got.
Illinois has tried medical marijuana. Do you think that's a good idea on the federal level?
Yes, I've been a supporter of medical marijuana, and statistics don't lie. Whenever medical marijuana is implemented into a state, opioid addiction goes down, and the rates of opioid addiction go down. I believe medical marijuana is exactly what I'm talking about. When doctors now have the option, if they believe that their patient is going to benefit from a much less addictive pain medicine like medicinal marijuana, I think they ought to have the opportunity to prescribe it.
Is that a non-starter on the Hill, or is that possible sometime soon?
Well, I think we're going to have the debate with more and more states like Illinois allowing recreational marijuana. We're going to have the debate on whether or not to take marijuana off the list of and the schedule of controlled substances that it's on. I'm somebody who I knew this was coming. I've been for years a states' rights person, and I believe it's the states' rights to be able to have their citizenry through referendum or through the legislature enact things like legalizing recreational marijuana. we ought to be able to make sure that those legally operating businesses that have been operating in states like Colorado and Washington and Oregon for years ought to have the ability to bank those dollars in our local financial institutions. I mean, I don't like to see businesses that are legally operating in any state have to worry about carrying loads and loads of cash around at a vault and have security when there's a local bank or credit union right down the street that they ought to be able to bank with like every other legally operating small business.
Well, in Illinois, the debate has also shifted to what about these folks who were convicted of marijuana possession in the war on drugs, and should their records be expunged? How would that work on the federal level, and where do you stand on that broad issue?
Well, what we've seen in Illinois, and I don't have the exact details of the expungement, you know, what that entails, so I'm not as up to date on that since they passed that bill. But federally speaking, I've always been in favor and have voted for criminal justice reform measures. I think it's tragic that what we've seen over the years, especially during the enforcement of anti-meth measures that we saw just a couple of years ago, you saw many people that were drug users serving time in prison and longer sentences, being a petty drug user, than people like Jared, the Subway guy, who was a pedophile. I think it's tragic when you have those petty drug users in jail longer than him, but just because he had money and a better lawyer doesn't mean he deserves a more of a break than somebody who has an addiction.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker talking with U.S. Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville. He's in town talking about opioid grants to Chestnut Health Systems. Let's move to tariffs. The president has suggested that tariffs are necessary against Mexico, and he wants, in exchange for holding off on those tariffs, Mexico to stop and deal more effectively with the undocumented immigration problem at the border. Is that an appropriate policy measure to use economic sanctions for a non-economic issue, do you think?
Well, it's certainly not the first administration that would do something like that. I'm not in favor of them using tariffs against Mexico right now to address immigration issues, but we can't close our eyes to the crisis that's happening in our border. We have the highest amount of individuals entering our country illegally along the southern border than we've had in decades. Something has to be done. But my message to the administration is that we had the solution on the table last July with two bills that would have addressed all of the president and the administration's concerns about border security, would have fully funded a border security structure along our southern border, would have addressed the institutional problems in our immigration system, too, for those who are legally going through the process. It takes too long and it costs too much. But it also would have provided a path to legal status for every single DACA kid and dreamer that's in this country right now. We would have also made sure that no families could be separated at the border unless anybody's suspected of human trafficking or something like that. That bill got zero Democrat votes. That bill only got, I believe, 112 of us Republicans voted for it. The president came in, told us personally as Republicans he was for it, and then right when it was crunch time, said, well, maybe we can solve this after the elections. That's not leadership. And the administration knows that using tariffs now, when we had a solution that was bipartisan, it should have been a bipartisan solution before, is not the answer. I'm worried that this new tariff proposal is going to knock us out of any chances of getting the USMCA through the House of Representatives. I believe with the new USMCA, I think it's a great deal. I think it's better for our farmers, it's better for our manufacturers, has worker protection standards that weren't in the last NAFTA for countries like Mexico and the United States and Canada, and we need to get this through. This administration has the ability, if this goes through and they can achieve bilateral agreements with China, Japan, South Korea, the UK, and also the EU, they have the chance to go down as one of the greatest administrations in our nation's history when it comes to global free trade. But they're on the precipice, Charlie, of being the worst ever if they don't get any of this done. And this tariff threat takes our eye off the ball when it comes to passing the USMCA through Congress.
Do you think people who think like you will have sway with the president? He seems pretty intent on this.
Well, the president is intent on a lot of issues. The president's the president. He's the first president we've had in our lifetime with no military, no governmental experience. The people of this country said they wanted somebody to come directly from the private sector and be president of the United States. He has a different way of doing things than presidents of the past. That's what the American people elected. And we've got to give him his due right to be able to make decisions. But I'm still going to stand up, and many of my colleagues are going to stand up and say, we think you need to do something different here.
Republican Representative Rodney Davis's 13th District stretches from the Metro East area to Bloomington Normal. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT Summer Concert comes from the City of Bloomington's Farmers Market, open 7:30 to noon every Saturday morning on the historic Museum Square. On June 8th, the city welcomes the Something Brothers and 3rd Street Down to GLT's Summer Concert. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, after years of declining funding for the arts, the state of Illinois budget includes a bump and a boost for arts in Bloomington Normal and across the state. America and Europe are marking the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings that led to the end of World War II. We're observing that today on Sound Ideas by rebroadcasting a piece GLT first aired 9 years ago. During World War II, more than 250 members of Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington served in the U.S. Armed Forces. The church collected oral histories from those who remained six decades later. We produced this audio postcard of those soldiers remembering their war.
It was a Sunday afternoon, and there's a gas station there, and coming out the radio, we heard zing, zing. They're coming in, and it hit the field, which meant very little to me. So we went on down to see the show at the castle. I come out of the movie theater, and up the street, they were howling, extra, extra. Japan had just bombed Pearl Harbor.
It was like the beginning of the end of the world, it seemed like. How could that happen?
And a lot of boys left instantly and joined up. And when I got out of U-High, I went to ISU. And then sometimes they would call a drill out on the field right when they were taking showers. And so you grabbed a towel or anything, you could grab and went out and stood on the field, you know, out in front of Fell Hall.
Everybody was joining. Mm-hmm. I mean, there weren't many high school kids, boys around anymore.
All of us were scared, not knowing what to expect.
We were on the East Coast of Greenland on a fjord and about 5 miles from the Arctic Circle.
Midway, it was totally different. Nothing but birds there. People and birds. And no women.
Ordered the Queen Mary, and then we left for Europe. Nobody was allowed on deck until we got way beyond the shoreline. The problem was people spying on the ship to tell how many people were on there. There were 19,000 of us. It wasn't the way to travel.
Well, what do you call bravery? You're scared as all get out when you're under fire, and but you do your job.
You don't dig a foxhole very far into a swamp. It immediately fills up with water.
I was young, dumb, and stupid. No, I mean it. You got a kid, mm-hmm. You just got out of high school, mm-hmm. Doesn't know for nothing. You did things because you had to do them. Might get some relief, maybe get 4 hours on and 4 hours off.
My unit went across the channel in gliders, and I recall looking down at, and there were so many ships at sea that had we been cut off from our tow plane, I don't think we could have hit the water.
I'm the first man up there at the minefield. It hadn't set any off. That'll wake you up too.
Sleeping alone, that's where I got hit first time. I got a shrapnel, but a potato masher.
See, this is when it was really cold, and the ground was frozen, and they were taking fire on the ground, and it would just bounce off of the ground and ricochet.
We're digging our foxhole deeper. Sniper got a couple men, and I had my head between my knees. But you have to raise your head up when you run down like this. Next time I brought the shovel up, zing, so a sniper come across. And I was real fortunate at that moment.
From Bastogne, they had a, what we call a fighting line, but we were stretched out, I think, something like 20 miles.
And he says, fire, fire. It takes two to fire the bazooka. So you man to fire the man to load it. You have to stand straight in the open. You're standing up there and big flames come out the back. And all of a sudden, we all them pill boxes are coming in on us.
One of the things that you cannot fight in any war, no matter where you put it, are the elements. We were up in the hurricane forest, and one night I got so mad because I couldn't walk anymore. I was diagnosed as trench foot. Got me all the way back to France, Paris. Boy, this is great. A bed with sheets. I hadn't seen one in 6 months.
And what we did basically, made sure that we treated him as we would be treated. A man has just surrendered his life to you. You know, you'd be two or three at a time. So you got to treat him as such, because he has saved your life and his life at the same time by him surrendering. So you take him back and you offer him a cigarette, and you decide if he wants to talk.
War, it's nasty. You are forced into many decisions that you don't have time to weigh what may happen. You just have to react to them.
He looked at me and grinned and took off his headphone and said, listen, the Japanese had surrendered while we were flying across the South Atlantic.
And the greatest thing I saw when we got into New York was the lady, Statue of Liberty. I could have gotten out there and kissed her. I thought that she looked beautiful.
I feel I did my duty. If they had wanted me to do more, I was there for them. But this is the way it happened. That's the way it is.
Veterans heard here include Ted Esch, Harlan Bliss, Ross Bubert, Rogers Friedland, Ray Knuckles, Dick Reed, George Fink, Paul Nelson, George Shaver, Jim Spillman, Joe Merrick, and Bill Semenchik. Many, if not all, of these veterans have passed away since the Oral History Project happened.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropists of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, one of the GLT summer concert acts, the Rebirth Brass Band. Illinois recently adopted $45 billion in a capital bill. It's intended to fix much of the state's crumbling infrastructure, but an unprecedented $50 million of that, or about a tenth of 1%, will be going to the arts and cultural programs in Illinois, specifically to address their building and maintenance needs. The state is doubling the gas tax and raising vehicle registration fees and the tobacco tax to pay for it. McLean County Arts Center Executive Director Doug Johnson was part of the state wide lobbying effort through the Arts Illinois Alliance. He hopes to bring some of that funding back to Illinois. He tells GLT's Eric Stock, many arts organizations across the state have been hanging by their fingernails following the budget stalemates of recent years, and that has caused some of those nonprofits to go under.
For a lot of organizations, like the McLean County Arts Center, we live on a shoestring budget, and the opportunity to have this infusion of capital support allows us to address lingering issues here. Particularly, we live in a great community, and we have a fantastic facility, but that facility is portions of it more than 100 years old, and that requires care and maintenance and upkeep and a number of things that our day-to-day operating budget doesn't always match. Away from here, there's organizations in Southern Illinois or Freeport that are taking on new projects, whether it's an arts plaza or a new arts facility that need that infusion of cash to help further drive local fundraising in order for those projects to really find a stakehold.
How many different programs could benefit from this financially, and how is that going to be determined?
Ultimately, there is an application process for groups to apply for these dollars. There are 35 lead organizations that have been identified as having initial shovel-ready projects. But all of us will be actually submitting an application to the Illinois Arts Council Agency, which is a state agency, and they'll be administering that grant review process for those monies to be allocated based on committee review and assessments based on how they fulfill the agendas, which will ultimately be more firmly established as the process goes on. I've served on many grant review panels for the Illinois Arts Council, and this is a bit of a different beast. The average annual budget for granting out through the Illinois Arts Council is about $13 million. So, and usually that's for program support or particular projects. So this is a vastly different animal than normally is assessed. So I'm confident that the state arts agency, working in collaboration with arts leaders from across the state, will come up with a workable plan that best fulfills the needs of our broader community.
Would you have a role on the agency in deciding where the funding goes?
Well, you know, I've served on a lot of different grant panels. I think because I've played such a lead role in seeking these funds, and because we'll be an applicant as well, I doubt I would be invited to serve on that panel. But it's you know, we have a rich community, broadly speaking, in the state, and I'm confident that a successful committee will be established.
But there's an expectation, I would imagine, that at least some of those dollars will make its way here to the Arts Center, where, as you said, part of the building is over a century old.
Yeah, oh, certainly. That was the whole impetus for participation. Not only were we able to represent downstate when we met with leaders in the state capitol, but we have a vested interest in improving the cultural life of our community, and these dollars will allow us to do that. Not just here at the McLean County Arts Center, but also the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts with their Creativity Center. They were certainly part of that ask, and we're hopeful that our local entities can really benefit from this state investment in our cultural enterprise.
It's been over a decade since Illinois had a capital bill which funded construction projects, infrastructure, transportation, and those kinds of things. To your recollection, has there ever been a program that has devoted specific dollars to arts projects in this manner?
No, I've been at the McLean County Arts Center leadership for coming on 18 years, and I have no recollection of this happening. And it really comes at an important time for the arts groups across the state. I did a study in my capacity as a board member of Arts Alliance Illinois, where we were able to make the assessment that 18% of all nonprofit arts groups across the state collapsed during the recent state budget upheavals. So to have this infusion to help revitalize those existing arts organizations can make a tremendous difference for the cultural life of our entire state.
One in six arts programs of the state folded. Funding had been cut from the state in the last decade?
Yeah. The number one indicator that a nonprofit is going to fail is the question, are they engaged in cultural enterprise? If an organization is invested in the arts, and if that is your primary mission, it is a complicated existence. And because so many of them exist on such a tight budget, not having even 10% of their funds come from the state completely hampers their ability to maintain their services for their community.
What kind of expectation did you have that you would be able to get some funding from the state for these projects under the new Pritzker administration?
Well, we had great hope. The Pritzker family has had a tremendous impact in the state. I mean, if you go to the Art Institute of Chicago, there's a Pritzker wing. If you go to Grant Park, it's Pritzker Pavilion. And that top-down leadership in investing in the arts and the cultural life of our community really changed the climate in Springfield. And the fact that we could go to Senator Bill Brady and say, gosh, you know, we really want to help infuse state support in these entities which are improving the cultural life of our community, that coupled with the governor's strong support of our cultural life, I think made a win-win for everyone.
But how did you make that case?
Well, ultimately, you know, we have to look at what are the things that are going to drive the economy within our community. And the arts play a lot of different roles. I mean, when we look at the business of running a community, it's ultimately about attracting workers and attracting people that can help enrich the lives of those businesses. And those businesses really need people that are creative and thoughtful and engaged and college graduates. And you can't have a community that attracts those people or retains those people once they've graduated unless you have a rich cultural life. So that's certainly part of it. You know, the other thing too is when we think about the cultural import of the arts in our community, let's just take the Sugar Creek Arts Festival, which is an event we run. We have, it's been estimated by police, we have about 20,000 people that attend that event over 2 days. Well, if we look at the economics of that, the Americans for the Arts estimates that the average attendee at an event, aside from ticket prices, for a cultural event, they spend $24. So bringing $24 in the community, you times that by the 20,000 people that attend, and you're looking at a dollar impact into Bloomington Normal of $480,000. It's a huge impact. And when you look at the cultural life that we bring, I mean, it's good for the community, it's good for the culture, but it's also good math.
Well, a number of legislators in our area and across the state, while rarely singling out any particular program or service, during tough budget times have gone to this common refrain of belt tightening, cutting out the waste, only essential services. To what extent have these programs sort of been swept up in this movement of fiscal discipline?
Well, yeah, if we look on a national level, if we look at the dollars that go for the National Endowment for the Arts, for example, you know, that was a program that really started under the Nixon administration. And right now, you know, we are spending less money for the arts nationally than Mexico. We're spending, you know, a tenth the dollars that Germany spends per capita.
That's McLean County Arts Center Executive Director Doug Johnson with GLT's Eric Stock. Johnson says the Arts Center's funding wish list includes tuck pointing to the original part of the building, redoing its parking lots, and adding curbs outside the building. And Johnson adds some of the building's air conditioning might need to be replaced as well. That went out a few hours before the interview. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Sports fandom was once the dominant cultural type of fandom, but that has changed in recent years. Now fandom is expressed in a variety of forms. In fact, this weekend in downtown Bloomington, fans of steampunk can participate in the Cogs and Corsets Steampunk Festival. Fandom has truly come into its own. That's according to a couple of guys who should know, GLT's Psych Geeks, where it was once supremely geeky and socially unacceptable to be a Trekkie. Now it's accepted and even considered cool. Fandom has moved center stage. But there's a dark side to the rise of fan culture, perhaps. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
We have entered a golden age of fandom. That's according to GLT's Psych Geeks, Scott Jordan and Eric Wesselman, both professors of psychology at Illinois State University. Wesselman says it's the abundance of entertainment choices and the technology that delivers them that gives us the opportunity to indulge in fan behavior. Jordan adds, fandom has come into its own, giving us a basic human need, a sense of belonging.
The reason that it's cool now is the same reason it was uncool 30 years ago, and that's normativity. 30 years ago, most people who were expressing fandom were expressing it in these sports types arenas where bodies are present, bodies are doing games, and a group of spectators that are observing. And that's a little different than being a fan of a TV show or being a fan of a book series. So there was no place where everybody went to watch TV together, or everybody went to read Harry Potter together. But with the advent of the internet, now there are these places where people can go actually sort of quote unquote be with each other around the fan content. It's become normative because there's been a space for it now.
The internet is certainly a boon for the social aspect, but also for access to the object itself too. So these sort of niche things, movies and TV before the video recorder, you know, you had to watch it at one time if you had access to it.
Welcome to the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. And well, and then some of the early work on fandom that focused on Star Trek and Beauty and the Beast, the TV series and things like that. All those groups had these mail-in fanzines to get in touch with each other. And then they started like swapping fan videos. Now you can just stream whatever you want, whenever you want.
Now that there's a space for it, it's normative.
It's given us a sense of belonging.
Always.
Is fandom really about what we admire, or is it really about us?
Most theories and research on fandom, at their core, it's about identity. There's something in that object that resonates with you. You attach to it, you bring it into your self-concept, it helps give you meaning, maybe nostalgia if it was something that you connected when you were a kid. And then the social aspect of it is you find others to belong with, which is also part of identity, and it distinguishes you, you and your group from others. So I like the Star Wars, I don't like the Star Trek, right? Even within Star Trek, you have people who call themselves Trekkies and you have people who call themselves Trekkers.
Yes.
And there's very clear boundaries.
I would argue that that's actually some of the appeal as well. It's not just what I like and who else likes it. It's also what we jointly dislike.
Mm.
And it's fun, right? It's a fun in-group, out-group space. So if you're a Trekker versus a Trekkie, you're going to have that conversation because that argument is actually bolstering your own identity, because part of your identity is that definition against some other group. In the sports world, these age-old rivalries, that's part of what attracts you to that team is who they're against.
I recently stumbled across some research where they've identified that portion of it they call anti-fans. Yeah, so there's fans and anti-fans. And so I don't know if that's – I'm not quite sure. I've got to read more about it, but maybe it's sort of hipster-ish, like I'm defined by what I don't like.
Oh, no. studied. So why do some movies, some characters, some TV shows or book series give rise to some kind of a strong fandom while others do not?
Time and place and then life course. So different stories are going to strike you a different way at different points in your life. So, for example, Star Wars. If you were 16 when you saw Mark Hamill look off into the sky, you know what that meant. You know, looking at it 30-some years later, it doesn't mean the same thing. So the different characters that come into fandom mean different things for you at different points in your life.
Accessibility is also key.
Oh,
I mean, you look at now with the internet, with streaming, you know, we can get word of mouth out there so much quicker. That buzz can be built, can be recommended, and there you go. Now, actually, maybe we have too much of a problem now and that there's too many options.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful, but like my queue of shows and movies to watch is I'm never going to be able to watch them all before I die.
Man, I love your first world problems.
Well, this is true. I mean, let me be clear. It's a good problem to have.
I'm totally
but...
with you. I have that same list. Accessibility is totally the case, though. And I think the advantage of the internet is we've transcended the decision-making dynamics of a few people in a boardroom at a network who are going to say, no, don't even finish the first season of Firefly. It's not worth it. Now, these things can get a new life because of things like Netflix. They can develop a fan base that they probably couldn't because just for the reasons you said, accessibility, if it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't there a bit of a problem also? There's a darker side to that, a sense of fan entitlement that they can tweet all they want. They can go to the cons and raise a stink about stuff. I mean, people were freaking out over the last season of Game of Thrones.
And
there were... The thing that really put the chill down my spine were the guys who took The Last Jedi and edited out all the women and put out a special edit of their own. That's what these Star Wars fans did. And so there's a sort of a darker side of the fans sort of like trying to take control of what's been created by other people. almost as if we're not having respect for the people who are the creators behind what we are fans of.
When this is part of your identity, lots of things are part of our identity, which we may or may not agree with in someone else, right? And so individuals who we might identify as racist or sexist or whatever, right? You know, certain perspectives of their worldview are part of their identity, right? And so when we get a story, you know, that we connect to, whatever way, that's part of our expectations. And when the next installment of that story violates our expectations in some way, whether it's a way that's socially accepted or a way that's not, we respond in kind. So if I don't like a particular set of characters in a movie that violates my worldview for whatever reason, maybe I will try to make it what I want it to be, right? In a most extreme sense.
And these days you can. You can create fan fiction. Mm. Other people can read it, and you can resonate in your dislike of the original text. I'm always defining the self in terms of borders, and borders are always about what you're not. So in that sense, we can call it a dark side, but for me, if you're in fandom, there's always going to be an other. And that's part of what we're relishing in when we do that fandom work. So there are dark sides. People are experiencing text and textuality differently now, because now they can jointly create in ways that they just couldn't even 10 years ago. And if it is part of your identity, then you, and someone messes up the story that's part of your identity, just write it over. You get a few other people to read it to resonate with you, so you feel like that's, you know, who you are and part of who you are, but you can do that now.
You can hear bonus audio of the Psych Geeks discussing the merits of fan fiction and more at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We hope you're fans of the show. Traditional New Orleans drums and horn sounds will accompany the Rebirth Brass Band when it plays the GLT Summer Concert in just 2 days. But according to drummer and founding member Keith Frazier, you'll also hear hip-hop, R&B, and other flavors. In this encore interview, Frazier tells GLT's John Norton, if you grow up in New Orleans, you're going to absorb the musical legacy of that city.
Well, growing up in New Orleans, you're surrounded by music and musical events all the time, as well as musicians who perform those events. As a kid, in other cities, you might get exposed to rock and roll, hip-hop, reggae, whatever the genre of music may be. But in New Orleans, you're exposed to live music. So you kind of grow up in it, and you want to be a part of it. And that's, a lot of kids get their start just by listening, and they just want to emulate what they see older guys do.
The band itself has absorbed so many different sounds. Obviously, you're a traditional New Orleans drum and brass band, but R&B, funk, hip-hop also are part of the mix now. Were you open to those new sounds from the beginning, or is that something that evolved over the years?
I think we were open to those sounds from the very beginning, because by us being so young, we were exposed to hip-hop, and so we tried to incorporate the hip-hop sounds into our music, while at the same time playing some traditional stuff, because older people would prefer the traditional type of music that we play.
How was the hip-hop working with the traditional brass sound initially? Was it something you really had to work it out, or was it a pretty natural fit?
It was something that we had to really work out, because the older people, or the older guys who were doing New Orleans music, they thought we were, like, disrespecting the history and of the traditional music. But we were trying to tell them, like, we want to play something that can capture the attention of younger people like ourselves. So we had to kind of work it out and get them to get on board with what we were doing.
What got the older guys on board for you to incorporate hip-hop and rap into it?
I think the thing that really got them on the board is that they saw a commitment to the older music, to the traditional music. They say, okay, these guys are playing a lot of traditional songs. And they saw that we weren't trying to completely change everything. We were just trying to add something to it.
Is that the same for funk and R&B, working that in as well, or was that a little bit easier?
The R&B part was a little bit easier, because a lot of bands before, such as the Olympia Brass Band or Dirty Dozen, they had already been playing like R&B type tunes in their repertoire of music. So that was a little easy to do. But the hip hop, by it being so new, that was something that they weren't readily available, you know, able to accept.
Well, Well, there's a number of different brass bands in New Orleans. How do you distinguish yourself from the other bands in town?
Like I said, one thing that we do is we play a lot of traditional tunes. And we play them in a new way, but we always go back to the traditional tunes. We like to start out a set with a song called Lord, Lord. It's a very traditional song. And we try to let people know where the music comes from, and then we take them to where the music has gone to. Whereas a lot of other brass bands, they jump right into the brand new stuff. They don't really mess around with the traditional stuff as much.
Okay, all right. How much of the music that you play is improvised versus arranged?
We have a lot of arranged songs. We have a certain format that we play the songs in, but there's a lot of improvisation that happens. Like the song Do What You Want, the song that we created, we can play it a million different ways. We know the format of the song, but we can always add something to it, even while we're on stage performing.
Yeah, Phil! Do what you want!
Talking with drummer Keith Frazier. He's with the Rebirth Brass Band. I want to ask you about the Roots of Music nonprofit that you have. It's a program that helps at-risk young guys, and probably gals too, learn how to play music. What was the driving force to set up that program?
Well, that particular program was the brainchild of our drummer, snare drum player, Derek Tabb. He saw that there was a need for kids who were at risk between the age of 9 and 14 to be involved in instrumental music. And right after Hurricane Katrina, most of the music programs in schools were taken away. He was like, hey, man, I have a great idea. Let's start a citywide band. And so along with the help of Allison, a lady by the name of Allison, he got together with her and they got the business part of it set up. And they started this citywide marching band. And it has just taken off since right after Katrina.
When you say citywide marching band, what do you mean by that?
Kids come from all parts of the city. They're not from just one area of the city. He got together with a bus company to go pick kids up at school and bus them to a central location to teach them instrumental music.
That's an interesting idea. We had the director of our Performing Arts Center a couple of years ago. She has since passed, unfortunately, but she had a saying that when kids are creating, they're not destroying.
We see that all the time. We said we'd rather give them instruments than, you know, put instruments in their hand and have them have guns in their hands. So it's very important to, you know, find something constructive for kids to do between those ages, because they're very, you know, impressionable. You know, they do what they see other people do. So if they see that, if you're a 9-year-old, you see your friend playing in a marching band, and it's something that he just learned to pick up, more than likely you're going to want to do something like that too. And at the same time, it's constructive. So it's important that we have those type of programs in place.
You're listening to GLT's Sound Ideas. Keith Frazier, drummer of the Rebirth Brass Band, is our guest. You won a Grammy in 2011 for the album The Rebirth of New Orleans.
That's correct.
A Best Regional Roots Album. Did that nomination come as sort of a surprise, or did you guys see that one coming?
It was a total surprise. We didn't know it was coming. The day we were nominated, we all had to go online and look at the nomination list because we couldn't believe that we were even nominated. We're nominated for a Grammy. So we're totally shocked, and when we actually won it, we were even more shocked to win it because it's really hard to win.
What did it mean to you to win that Grammy?
It meant that our peers recognized us for doing something that was noteworthy. And so we was like, okay, now these guys actually recognize guys who play this type of music as well. So it made us feel really good.
It's been 35 years, roughly, since the birth of the Rebirth Brass Band. What kind of differences have you seen, even from your fans, from some 30-some years ago to today? Are they wanting something different? Do they want the same thing as 30 years ago? What's the difference?
We've seen one of the differences that I've seen is that there's a lot more interest in instrumental music. You know, people think of guys playing instruments as something being geeky or something that's not hip or cool. Now that younger people seeing that, you know, playing an instrument and being involved in that is actually cool. It's something that I was doing in high school or junior high school marching band, and these guys are taking it and brought it to another level. So that's one of the things we've seen.
Well, cool. Keith Frazier, nice to talk with you, and I know a lot of folks looking forward to seeing you with the Rebirth Brass Band.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
The Rebirth Brass Band is one of four acts performing at the GLT Summer Concert presented by CEFQ. Atlantic Records artist Adia Victoria headlines the show Saturday in downtown Bloomington with special guests The Something Brothers and Third Street Down. More information about the summer concert is at WGLT.org. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, John Norton, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.